Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so, Cindy, we talked about doing a couple of basic primers on wine from different places in the world, and we're going to begin with your giant prejudice towards...
French wine, yay! I love French wine.
Yeah.
This is good. A primer is awesome. You know, we need to all understand what the story is, so...
Well, I know you have a lot of...
There are a billion questions I could ask you.
You have a lot of basic questions for me.
I can start off with, why are we doing a primer on French wine? Why do you think that's
important?
I was
going to ask you a couple of basic questions.
Oh, God, of course. All right, let's go. Oh, goody.
So, okay, there are three meals a day, right?
Well, hopefully.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right.
So which are your favorite French wines for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Champagne.
Okay.
Surprise.
So that now the audience knows from the perspective from which
the interviewer
is speaking. unless champagne is contained in the phrase, she may not be paying full attention.
Oh, that's not true. Okay. I love French wine. And I love the fact that there's tremendous history behind the wine. Should we start with some history maybe talking about the varietals?
You're asking some of the, like, why talk about French wine now? Why have a bit of a primer? One of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is that the American wine-consuming public has gotten a little bit away from they're much more of an experiential approach towards wine and much less of I want to be guided by a number score this is the accepted thing.
That's a big change, right?
Yeah, the level of curiosity and the desire towards wine is an experience, and oftentimes a shared experience. I mean, how many different tasting groups and tasting dinners
and
whatnot?
That's pretty exciting change.
It's a very cool thing. I mean,
it's more organic rather than maybe intellectual or.
It's a change in our culture that's really a maturation in our culture of how we're and you've seen it happen with food.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen people's interest in many different things in food
for
grow.
Sure, which is so exciting. I mean, that's the best thing that could possibly happen to a chef, so it's got to be the best thing that could happen to a winemaker.
Well, and the thing is that people are starting to figure out that, you know, it's a funny thing. This food and wine pairing has been a very big topic for people in the public recently. What is the thing for this?
Right.
It used to be I'd have to spend a lot of time explaining to guests in restaurants, I'd often use a very simple sort of analogy. You may have a very favorite necktie. You may have a very favorite shirt. When you put them on together, do you always look your best? No, you may look like a big jerk.
Okay.
Food and wine kind of works the same way. And so I don't want to say that the only place in the world, but maybe the place that started to sort of organize wine first was France. And it is a good place to start as a bit of a primer. And even though the growing wine in Italy is older, it was more organized first in France as far as how things are sort of classified by place. And classification by place remains classification by place remains the biggest difference, the biggest gulf.
Designation.
Yeah. Well, like how you know what something is or what it's called. You know,
right.
That's because, let's say... Wines that you immediately think of, and you're an American wine consumer, so you think of things oftentimes, even though you've had a lot of French wine, by varietal names.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
What are some varietal names that you know?
Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, but not from America.
Yeah, I mean, but in America, we know them by the names, and that's because we took grapes from other places, planted them, and we only really have we don't have a 800-year history of growing Grenache in this area in France.
Instead of, what, thousands of years?
Well, it depends on where it is. And this is where I'm going to sort of, even though the French organized it first, the Italians grew it all first.
Mm-hmm.
And a large majority of vines that are in France are variations on or adaptations of vines that came from Italy, which is really... super crazy interesting, and that's a very long, unbelievably snore-filled program to do for some time in the future, never.
We don't want people snoring.
But that's the reality of it. And this kind of, you know, the knowing things by place name is a big deal, and you really need to spend a little bit of time with a map.
Well, I think that's the thing with a French label. I mean, it's going to say bone or shut enough to pop.
But it's going to say it in things like bone sounds like B-O-N-E to us, right?
Right.
But bone,
right,
to a Frenchman is B-E-A-U-N-E,
mm-hmm,
which to my American sensibilities seems fancy and a little odd, and
right,
why did I enunciate it exactly that way? And mm-hmm, and we get a little bit scared of the language part of it, too.
Sure, well, that's understandable.
There's a simple economic reason that right now, for the exchange between the euro and the dollar, if you want to learn French wine and explore a little bit, the exchange between the euro and the dollar is more in our favor than it's been for the most part for a decade.
Exactly, yeah.
So if you're going to play, the vintages to look for are going to be probably 14s, mm-hmm, 15s, depending upon the quality of 15s. 14 in general is a pretty decent vintage in a lot of parts of France.
Okay.
12s and 13s would have been priced off of, and 13s largely not a great vintage, except for Alsace. But 13s and 12s would have been priced off of a pretty high exchange.
Okay. So that's exciting, though, that we have this opportunity
to taste wine from France
at a better price range. Yeah. So when it comes to varietals, what are we talking about in France? And how does it relate to the regions? Or does it not necessarily? Are they all over the place? What are we talking about with varietals?
They are all over the place. And some of them are familiar to us. The most famous regions in France, and there are four or five that really are the most famous regions, those are the grapes that we know the best. Bordeaux and Burgundy are the probably the two most famous besides Champagne.
Mm-hmm.
See, I got Champagne
Thank
snuck
you, Tony.
In. Yeah, there you
uh-huh.
go. And the grapes in Champagne are essentially the same as you see in Burgundy. So
okay.
Burgundy is a cooler growing region, and it's Pinot Noir and Chardonnay is what
mm-hmm.
you see there.
Mm-hmm.
And Bordeaux is largely red wine. And Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot are the two most important there.
Mm-hmm.
You see three others, but mm-hmm. those are the two most important there. Merlot is the most widely grown grape in Bordeaux
mm-hmm.
for a bunch of different reasons. And white in Bordeaux, Sauvignon Blanc, is the most important of those grapes.
Okay.
So those five grapes cover an awful lot of what we see in the U.S. for varietals and what have become popular international varietals. And that has to do with the success of Burgundy and Bordeaux for the last 150, 200 years commercially. And you know, wine is a commodity around the world.
So with the AOC system, what is it and what does that mean exactly?
Here is the terrible thing. Here is the thing that people start reading a book on French wine and they're like, oh, my God, there's a set of regulations. I'm not going to read. It's like reading the IRS tax
code.
It's
overwhelming, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get a few of us that are wine CPAs that are like, oh, this is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder when this AOC was founded. Oh, 1935. Who is the inspector? What did he do? Blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, no, exactly uh-huh. right. Mm-hmm. No one wants to
I just
know
want
that.
To drink the wine, ultimately.
There you go, there you go, there you
and
go.
And eat some good food.
Results orientation.
Yes,
right?
indeed. I,
yeah.
I am a chef
we
after
chef,
all.
We chef,
exactly.
we chef.
Exactly.
So the AOC system is the appellation, okay, d'origine contrôlée, which literally means that the site and how wine is produced in that site is controlled.
Okay.
In other words, it's a quality assurance. If you knew that the eggs that you bought from Somerset County, Maryland, were always from organically raised chickens, and they're always coming to market within 24 hours.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It would be
yeah,
amazing,
that
right?
would be amazing, right.
We'd have to have some kind of particular FDA regulation or whatever it might be. The AOC system started in 1930. It's based on a system that actually began in 1905 in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, where you had to harvest at a certain time, late enough in the season, so you actually had ripe grapes.
Okay.
You had to get to certain alcohol levels to assure that the wine would actually hold for a while, and that you're being essentially regulations that you're a conscientious grower of the wine, and that certain grapes were used, and it's within a demarcated geographical area.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you were growing wine in, Sparks in Baltimore County,
mm-hmm.
which there's not but so much of that that goes on, but within Sparks, that would mean that there, someone would have taken the time to figure out what the 41 acres of best growing places for grapes would be and what the grapes would be that would grow well there. So if you bought wine that was called Sparks, you would know it was all harvested after September 10th from, let's say, Zinfandel grapes, or, you know, and that the alcohol level is at least 12%.
Okay.
And so you at least have a shot at knowing that Sparks,
basic things.
2015,
right.
You're going to get basic, you're going to get some kind of basic quality assessment insurance.
Okay.
So just having the name of that place on the label. And let's say that instead of just Zinfandel, but the tradition in Sparks was to grow 15 different varietals or four different varietals and to blend them differently, because in those 41 acres there were different soil types and different grapes did well in different soils. And the tradition to make wine that was more attractive to drink was to have a blend of those things. Then you'd know, you would know that was the case from Sparks being on the label. We're not accustomed to that. You know, so it's kind of a shorthand that if you begin to learn the map and some of the basics of the place around France, you begin to learn that shorthand and it becomes, oh, the Bordeaux vintage is strong in 2009 and it's particularly strong in, say, the villages of Pomerol and Saint-Emilion and Saint-Estèphe, you know, and some of the satellite appellations as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would know that, and you would know that those are areas that grow a lot of Merlot. And Merlot is a year, it was a year, the weather pattern favored Merlot, if that makes sense.
Sure, it does. And
but it's literally just kind of a shorthand of, oh, it's an 09 Pomerol. Probably a reasonable bet it's going to be pretty terrific to drink right now with food that's good, you know?
Right.
What chef wants.
And with the AOC, does it designate food as well, or is that a different designation for food?
There are designations of all kinds of agricultural products.
In France,
products.
I mean, yeah.
Remember that in France, the wine is just an agricultural product.
Right.
Olive oil from Provence is an agricultural product. Chickens from Bresse.
So it's not called an AOC?
It is called an AOC.
Oh, it is. So they're AOCs,
and
they're but
542 AOCs for cheese.
Got it. Yeah, I thought so. I just want to make sure that it was AOC.
542 kinds of cheese.
That's awesome. God, you regulated. Have to love France. 542.
I don't know that
cheeses.
I will admit that I'm enough of an American that I don't know if I want regulations on 542 cheeses.
Oh, well, no. Only they have to deal with it. We don't. I mean, I don't want that here.
You just
want to
consume the good stuff.
I just want to eat it. It all comes down to these basic things.
But it does mean that if something has X name, there is some level of quality assurance.
You're assured something, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does this compare with the rest of Europe and the rest of the world, AOC?
To give you an idea, and I said France organized it first, the French system began in the 30s, and they mapped it pretty seriously.
Okay.
And an awful lot of what was mapped then continues to be exactly right. Think about how agrarian the society was at that time and how good these guys were. If something's been selling for a better price from this place, I mean, Bordeaux did classifications in 1855, and that is sort of the cornerstone of making it easy for consumers around the world to buy their wine and know what the best, quote-unquote, is going to be, because they had first growth, second, third, fourth, fifth, Cru Bourgeois, all that kind of business. Just having things, the difference between Châteauneuf-du-Pape and a vineyard right next door, Côte du Rhône-Village, has to do with someone in 1931 going and digging in the soil and seeing where the soil changed and talking to and interviewing farmers and drawing a very complicated map and also naming all the different places and stuff. It's kind of a crazy thing. In shorthand, from 1930 to 1960, France was alone. In the 60s, the Italians started. In the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, the Germans and the Austrians started.
What's the Italian
Spain
called?
Spain got a little more, the DOC or DOCG.
Okay.
Because Italy being Italy would take probably three programs just to get through what is a very complicated system of being not as organized as you might hope for, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back, let's get into some of the different regions and we have a few more basics to cover, but we should get into some of the basic regions on our French Wine Primer on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're trying to do a little bit of a primer on French wine mm-hmm. without turning it into, and my apologies to all the CPAs out there, but without turning it into the tax code or into something scary.
Giving it a little bit of laughter and sexiness. Is that what you're saying, Tony?
No, that is exactly what you're saying.
All right, so what are the famous and less famous
regions?
I
would do a ridiculous French accent if I was going to add in laughter and sexiness.
Could you do the rest of the
show? My favorite wine in pantaloons.
Oh, boy.
There we go. See?
All right.
There you go. Just for you.
Thank you, Tony.
Okay.
So what are the famous regions and maybe some of the not so famous regions in France?
Well, you can name a lot of them. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the ones that you know, maybe ones that just other consumers know or know of. So if you want, you can just kind of pick a region and quiz me on what are some of the basics of the region.
Ooh, let's start with one that they know less, Loire Valley.
Okay. Loire, uh-huh. Loire Valley is big and long. And I mean, Loire River is 600 miles across France. Mm-hmm. It kind of cuts it in half. It's not that far south of Paris when you get to that center of France.
And it's a beautiful region with a lot of beautiful chateaus. I'll just throw that in there.
I was going
to
say, it's
a great place to
visit.
It is
a great, like, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Chenonceau is there.
May, June visit.
Yes. Chambord. Just so many. Oh, it's a gorgeous. Yeah, exactly. Springtime.
It's
summertime.
It's definitely summer picnic country.
And lots of animals. I mean, there's a lot of farmland there. So whether it's, you know, produce or farm life.
It's been well protected because
animals,
it's right in the center of France. And you can spend quality time with farm animals
as
well as enjoy the wine of the region.
No, means the food is good.
They're really kind of, and there's wine grown all along that river valley.
Mm.
All the way in the west on the Atlantic, you see one of the wines is something of a, and there are a lot of French wine names that are almost cliche because they were the thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
To eat with raw oysters is Muscadet.
Mm-hmm.
Muscadet is from the Melon grape, and that's from the very far west, right at the mouth of the river into the Atlantic. It's a cool region. It's a white wine that's very light, very clean, lower alcohol, and does beautifully with it shows its fruit well with the saltiness of the oysters. And that's almost that is one of the great old examples of what grows together goes together.
Right.
Like
exactly.
They harvest the oysters. And this is the wine from the vineyards that are close by. And you know what?
They're perfect.
They're fantastic together.
Right. So what's the soil like in that area, especially with a river going through it and coastal?
It's gravelly sand for mm-hmm. the most part.
Okay.
I mean, that's,
and is it a sunny place?
It's too far north. It's more varied than you think it would be.
Okay.
It is not that sunny. I mean, that's one of the reasons one of the reasons the alcohol does not get that high. You're looking usually at 11.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a big warm year, maybe 12%.
I think that's interesting to understand about a region is, you know, hey, it's a cold region. It's not going to have as high of an alcohol content.
Well, France is, you have the influence of the ocean in the west. You have mountain ranges that protect certain regions. So learning the map really can tell you a lot about what's going to be possible to happen wine-wise in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
You all the way from there down to the Côte de Roussillon, right on the Spanish border, and it kind of looks like a desert. It's super crazy dry.
Yeah.
It's right by the Mediterranean.
Big change. Yes.
And you get wines that are 15.5% alcohol, even naturally sweet wines that have alcohol levels that would be 16.5, 17, like Banyuls. And this is all within a country that's, you know, that's maybe, I don't know how long the drive is, but you're talking about something that's 80% the size of Texas. It's not a giant place.
Right.
And that's not the longest distance between, but the weather patterns are so different.
And what's the grape varietal there in the Roussillon?
In the Côte de Roussillon, it's Grenache and Carignan.
Mm-hmm.
Carignan is Carignan, and Grenache is like your mom's box Grenache Rosé from the fridge, Grenache. Those are the two grapes that, it's going to sound a little ridiculous, but it's true, that translate that soil the best. They're adapted well to that climate. They're old Mediterranean grapes, and they translate the soil there as far as getting mineral flavors across. One of the things about growing grapes in any place, whether it's that Melon grape that does well all the way in that cool site in Muscadet, or Grenache and Carignan that do well down in the Côte de Roussillon, is they're grapes adapted to the weather, but they're also, they're able to be focused and literally get across the mineral flavor of the place. And in the end, you become a little bit tired of just the fruit juice.
Okay.
Or fruit juice that gets translated into alcohol. It becomes a little more interesting when there's a little extra personality or spirit that's there. And when you can notice that the earth is speaking a bit through, you know, from that site. That's that idea of terroir. Terroir.
I was going to say, now you're describing exactly what terroir means, and
it's
a lot of people
that
not
combination of
understand it.
The weather, the soil, that particular growing season. There's a story to tell for that vine of what its life was like.
Yeah.
It's like, I've been here for eight generations. You know, that's...
I've dug my roots down many feet.
The spring was like this. Mm-hmm. The summer was like this.
Mm-hmm.
Harvest decisions were made like this.
It hailed one day and I had all my leaves.
My winemaking was done in a clean way.
Right.
So I can live a long time and tell the story of what has happened.
I love that. That's what's so cool
wine. Of my life as a vine and my ancestors.
It does reflect.
If you history. Slow down yourself enough to take it all in, sensually, you can also absorb it intellectually, and
that's really fascinating.
A weird little, this is not purely my alcoholism speaking, but this is is a funny little tuning into the earth and its cycles that can go on. That's contemplative. That's very interesting about wine from places, and that's literally what the excitement about French wine is from. Not just that the wine may go with the dish. Or this may be really tasty in that sort of fruit juice and alcohol way, but that it's going to have more to say than just those things.
Mm-hmm. What producers from the Loire and the Roussillon do you like, or would you point out?
Well, let's stick to the Loire for a minute, because I was just using them as disparate examples of weather patterns.
Okay.
In Loire, you have sort of three big areas. In this, we talked with Muscadet coming from the west, all the way at the ocean. There's a big, broad center. There's a red wine that is made largely from Cabernet Franc there. The most famous place for that is Chinon, C-H-I-N-O-N. And these are light to medium-bodied red wines that are more sort of blue fruit and can be kind of vegetal depending upon the year. And the warmest years are the wines that are usually the most attractive and the least vegetal, but they're always going to have some of that vegetal flavor. And they do well with particular dishes, the game that the Loire is famous for, they do very well with. There's not a lot of tannin, but if you're hunting venison or hunting quail or something that's in the wild,
there's no fat.
There's intense flavor, like Chinon has, but there's not that much fat. It's nice to have the acidity. It's nice to have the intensity, but you don't need the tannin, that sort of chalky material that's there in bigger red wines that kind of bites into like the big fat in a steak or something
tannin.
Like that.
Got it.
That's the most famous red that comes from the center. The whites that come from the center, the most probably important and ubiquitous and popular for a long time has been Vouvray. And Vouvray is made from Chenin Blanc as a grape. And there are many wines, dry and sweet, made from Chenin Blanc. Chenin Blanc has a pretty high acidity naturally and a kind of in a citrusy way, almost like tangerines or grapefruits or pomelos or something. And they have a very crystalline kind of intense fruit. And they can often be a little more attractive if they're left a little bit sweet because that acidity is so high. They seem out of balance if they're perfectly bone dry sometimes. And Vouvray is made in dry, medium sweet, and sweet styles, and also in sparkling, which can be really fun and not crazy expensive.
Okay. And thus, with the Saint-Marc cheese, which is famous in that region, what do you like to drink with that?
Well, Saint-Marc comes from a little bit further east from the Touraine. It's Saint-Marc de Touraine. And the wine from Touraine is all Sauvignon Blanc. There's kind of a divide in the center of the Loire Valley between Chenin Blanc growing regions and Sauvignon Blanc growing regions. And the Sauvignons in the Loire are the really crispy, flinty, bright, a little bit lower alcohol, less fruity versions. And Touraine is one of the less famous ones, but is delicious and a good value. And that can be terrific with Saint-Marc du Touraine, the goat cheese from there. Further east, the most famous Sauvignons in the Loire, Sancerre, which is pretty darn well known and is almost one of those cliche names.
Okay.
And that's a very crispy, seems fruity, but there's no sugar there. And Sancerre is from far in the east, almost towards Burgundy, and from, this is going to sound ridiculous, Camarigian soils, which are the same chalky soils you see in Champagne or you see in Chablis. And it has that bright, flinty earth that you see in Champagne or in Chablis as well. Mm-hmm. But it's Sauvignon Blanc that's grown there. And Puy Fumé, which is right across the river. And literally, Puy Fumé is the town of Puy on the Loire. And it has a hillside that tends to be cloudy in the morning, hence Fumé, smoky.
Oh, that's cool.
So good. It's right behind the town. The vineyards on the hill are the smoky vineyards of Puy Fumé.
That's cool to hear.
From there. Mm-hmm. And those clouds always make it a little less ripe and a little less like crispy fruity than Sancerre. And it's also usually maybe a better purchase than Sancerre because it's not as well known.
Okay.
And so, but they're your sort of Loire basics.
Okay.
So pick another region.
How about Alsace, which is so different, it feels like.
Alsace is so different. And Alsace is in the far northeast of the country. And when you look at a map of France, immediately there's kind of, the map of France almost looks like your hand splayed out. And if there was if your hand was palm down, that pinky that shot off to the mm-hmm. to the northeast is Alsace.
Okay.
And on the way to that pinky, there is a mountain range called the Vosges. And that mountain range stops weather from coming across France. And Alsace is the second sunniest region. Here's what you don't like. It's cool because it's northeast.
Sure.
And it's continental. And it was part of Germany for a long time. But it's cool but sunny. You get very good ripeness of a lot of grape varietals there. And the other thing that's interesting in Alsace is and these are the long, tall German-looking bottles that scare us because we think there's going to be residual sugar there. Those wines are often varietally labeled. That has been the tradition for the last 150 years or so. Prior to that, they're always field blends. People grew what did well in certain sites, and they would name it for the site.
Okay.
But sort of, I think because of the border flipping back and forth to remain commercially viable and to be a little more predictable as far as the sweetness level of the wines, they started varietally labeling the wines about 150 years ago. Before the Franco-Prussian War, actually.
And what are those varietals?
The dry ones, typically Pinot Blanc or Pinot Auxerrois, Sylvaner, not so well known, but a little bit lower in alcohol, and can be clean. Muscat is usually dry, but smells like it's going to be really exotic. Mm-hmm. Muscat, right? Mm-hmm. Riesling usually is pretty darn dry in Alsace. A little bit of residual sugar, but the acidity is pretty intense. And Riesling is the pride of and the ones that age the longest in Alsace. And that's something that half of the discussion in Alsace, the winemakers, is about Riesling, and the other half is about all the other varietals.
Wow. So they must pick earlier than everyone else because it's so warm there.
No,
or that there's more sun.
It's sunny,
there.
But it's not
it's
warmer.
It's not warmer. Okay.
So right. They tend to have nice ripening but slow ripening and good acidity because of the cooler nights because of the weather pattern. So if you want very fresh wines with good intensity, and these are almost all white wines, the only red you see grown there is Pinot Noir, and it is not often attractive. It's hard to ripen red wine that far north and get the skins ripe, which gives you ripe tannins. Otherwise, you get green tannins. Tannins are almost like tea,
okay,
like iced tea that's been oversteeped, and that's kind of tough. But the other varietals to know for sure are Gewürztraminer, which tends to be the sweetest of them. And they'll harvest that where they're 25 to 30 or 35, 40 grams of residual sugar, which comes off as pretty sweet. But the wines are intense and really is a bit of a treat. And Pinot Gris, which is the same grape as Pinot Grigio in Italy. But it's kind of an interesting phenomenon to see it in a richer, it's almost like a smoky apple pie, but dry, like the size of California Chardonnay kind of wine without the oak. Most of the tradition in Alsace is to do wines without oak.
Okay. Should we move to Bordeaux?
We can move to Bordeaux. We did a little bit of a start, and Bordeaux is sort of a giant thing to know. Bordeaux is the most productive region in France as far as how much wine is actually grown. Those five grapes, the reds, I sort of mentioned two, Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Franc, but a different version of it than you see in Loire, is grown there. Malbec, a very small quantity of it. And not like the Argentinian Malbec, which is really raised in a high desert. This is just this is in the river plateau. And very mild, consistent weather river plateau in Bordeaux, because they're coming off the seacoast there. And Petit Verdot, which is a big black inky wine. And these are the wines that, with the legendary aging, that's the you know, when you're turning 50, you know, go and find the best wine of your vintage. And if it's well kept, you're going to be able to drink it and enjoy it. It's going to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. You may pay dearly for it because the entire world has been chasing Bordeaux for a long time.
Right.
And these are relatively big, rich, firm red wines that have tannin, that have acidity, that age a long time, that have good levels of complexity. White wines in Bordeaux, those Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon is the other important grape. Those whites, some from a few places, age very well, but not from very many. There's a certain large quantity of Bordeaux whites that is dry, fruity Sauvignon meant for early consumption. That's great summer wine. There is some that's meant for aging a long time from the most famous couple of sites, and they're crazy expensive. Maybe the world's most famous sweet wine is also from Bordeaux, and that's Sauterne. And these are white wines made from Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc, those two same grapes, but that get a noble rot, or a sort of almost like a mold that takes all the water out of the grapes, intensifies them. They let them become oversweet on the vine. They remove those skins, and that very intense juice they make into very sweet, almost nectar, mm-hmm. that is aged in oak
so
barrels.
Beautiful. It can be so pretty.
And that can live a very, very long time. I've had some Sauternes, you know, well over 100 years old. And I know we had a bottle from the 20s.
Mm-hmm. That was really special to taste.
That was amazing to taste.
And the color, everything about it. That was such an opportunity to get to taste something that was that old.
It was great. When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we're going to run through a few more regions in France.
Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I'm Tony Foreman.
And we were just talking about Bordeaux. We're going through the regions of France, and I think we ought to talk a little bit about food in Bordeaux, because I know the winemakers think about their regional cooking they're making...
And it's heavy.
It is not.
It is. All the traditional stuff is pretty heavy. All the charcuterie is big, rich, you know, like...
It's heavy in a good way.
Graton, the pork nectarine, and... Mm-hmm. You know, the river eel cooked in red wine and mutton and, you know, goose confit.
Good beef. They have good beef there. Yeah.
Lamb. I mean, that's...
Lamb. Mm-hmm.
Lamb from Pauillac, one of the famous regions for Cabernet Sauvignon-based wines. You know, lamb from Pauillac is super famous. Chateau Ponte Canet raised a lot more sheep than it did wine for a large majority of its history.
We should probably move on to Burgundy. We have a lot of regions to cover. Okay. So with Burgundy, you know, I think the soil there is so interesting, and the fact that the vineyard sites can be so small. I think that's really, what would you say about those aspects of, and the grape varietals for that region?
Well, the varietals are easy. That's the thing.
That's what I like about
the
Burgundy.
Only thing it's easy about
Burgundy. It's easy to remember.
Yeah, red wines are Pinot Noir. White wines are Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. There are a very few white wines that are Aligoté, and we're not going to really get into it, but that's very different from Chardonnay. Chardonnay from Burgundy is very different in character than you see from California. Usually the wines, and these are mostly oak-aged, and there's a couple different regions in Burgundy that grow, greater Burgundy, that grow Chardonnay. Chablis to the north, which is going to be from that different soil I was talking about, Cameridgian soil, and those are brighter, more almost sort of laser sharp, crystalline, more medium than full usually wines. Very distinctive character, but not super generous as far as their body and their fruit personality. From the Côte d'Or, that central region, and the Côte de Beaune is the famous region for mm-hmm. whites from Chardonnay there. And Merceau, Pligny-Montrachet, a lot of the very famous names, you know, historically. Are the villages there that grow Chardonnay.
And what's happening with the soil changes? I mean, I know it can be from one site
to
the next.
Well, the soil changes, and there's different types of clay without getting into it in depth.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of little differences in drainage and exposure that have to do with how things ripen and when they flower
and up the hill and down in the valley floor.
Yeah.
You know, you've got so many different sites.
And a lot of those vineyards are not so steep. It's not like some of the famous red wine regions of the Côte de Nuit that are on much, you know, sort of more steep hill faces, but this is kind of gentle and it's super, super interesting variations between them. But those are the classic, you know, generous but very mineral wines that you expect from Chardonnay from the Côte d'Or. further south in Mâcon or the Côte Chalonnais, you get things that are a little less distinctive aromatically and as far as, say, the mineral content, but more generous as far as they see a little more sun. The skin's a little thicker on the Chardonnay. You get bigger fruit characters. And often, Puy-Fuissé is the most famous, you know, or Mâcon Village, mm-hmm. well known, and remains a pretty good purchase in good vintages, like 2012 was, for Chardonnay, to give you some idea of wines from this
area.
What
would you say about vintages for Burgundy?
Super important.
Yes.
I mean, that's that.
Okay.
Burgundy is the minefield of learning about wine with your pocket. That's the thing. That's the toughest thing. It really has to be a project, and it's not every time. You may buy a case of wine of something from a magnificent site and a great grower and a great year, and it's going to show a little bit differently every time, because especially in the reds, these are delicate wines that go through very complex evolutions. This is a northern place to grow Pinot Noir, which is the red wine. And a lot of the famous red wine places in the world, Von Romanée, Orgeval-Chambertin, Moret-Saint-Denis, some of the Grand Crus, Clos Vougeot, Richebourg.
Such a beautiful place.
They're magnificent things, but I'm never going to say that I have not been disappointed at times with a very, very expensive bottle of something from one of these places. The thing is that when they hit, when they are the real thing, there is a magic of expression that is not, it's not exactly contained in any other wine, and it's not exactly of this world, let's say. When I say magic, there literally is, there are little things that happen in the perfume of some of these wines that are complex and interesting, and these are not great, big, dense red wines with, you know, immediate, obvious power. But it's a little bit like having someone tap you with a feather and you fall a long way as opposed to being punched in the gut.
Right.
A lot further away from the ground than you thought you were going to be.
And isn't there...
But it doesn't always happen. And sometimes you're out, you know, $100 or more a bottle for something and it's not behaving the way that it's capable of behaving sometimes. And that sounds ridiculous, but I swear it's true. And I've tasted an awful lot of wines from this place and in that place and with growers in that place. And the particular mysteries of Burgundy are maybe one of the more wonderful and self-flagellating ways to go about wine consumption and learning France.
With the history of the region, it plays a pretty big part into the parcels of land and how it started and the church.
Right. So much of the parcels were owned by the church and slowly got broken up or bought off by different families, and then French inheritance laws have everything to do with a parcel being broken into four different pieces, and then through marriage that piece becomes part of this other guy's piece of that mm-hmm. parcel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Burgundy is its own very complex. Just the map alone will give you a bit of a headache. It's marvelous, but it is a rabbit hole to chase down.
Okay, maybe we should move to Champagne.
Good transition, because Pinot Noir and Chardonnay are two of the grapes that are grown in Champagne. Here's the funny thing in Champagne, for a region that grows almost no red wine, most of the grapes grown are red grapes. Pinot Noir and a cousin of it in the same family, Pinot Meunier, are the two red grapes, and Chardonnay is the white grape. And in the soils there in Champagne, and there are a couple of different regions within Champagne proper, and the production of Champagne is huge. And I think it does. While it doesn't rival Bordeaux, it's still millions and millions of bottles per house for the large houses that you know, like Tatinger or Veuve Clicquot or Moët Chandon or one of these guys.
It carries cachet. People are interested in Champagne. I think Champagne just has a whole different feeling than any other region.
Well, Champagne is a little bit of a victim of its own success, because the name became so ubiquitous for a sparkling wine for celebration that every region in the world that grows sparkling wine, we often misnomer the wines as Champagne,
mm-hmm.
whether it's Conca or Cava in Spain, or Prosecco in Italy, or some other kind of Italian spumante, or a sparkling wine from the West Coast is delicious. It's still not Champagne. Champagne is both the place, that region, and that is the northernmost region in France for growing wine. And it is also the method, the way the sparkling wine gets made in that region. And it's an interesting process for sure.
What are the, you know, some of the factors in the Rhone Valley wines that really distinguish them? You know, hours of sun, temperature, soil, season, vine adaptation, all these things that make the Rhone such a special region.
Those are great geeky questions. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing to note, one little easy sort of key is you think of the Loire Valley going east-west and being really long. The Rhone Valley is pretty darn long. It goes from Lyon. And by the way, the one thing in Burgundy we didn't tackle, the thing that's between sort of Burgundy proper, and politically it was part of Burgundy with Beaujolais, but soil-wise, it actually almost is more like the northernmost part of the Rhone Valley, because those are granite soils. And the wines there are not just the fruity red wines we always think of for Beaujolais. Quality-price ratio of Beaujolais can be very, very interesting. It's not just Nouveau, and can be terrific bistro wines for the table, for
sure. I love the wines from Beaujolais. Some of the tastings we had when we were there were brilliant. What were some of your favorite houses in Beaujolais?
They're bunches and bunches. Chateau Thivin is one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to begin to learn are the different crews, the names, the different villages in Beaujolais. But that is that place in between Burgundy and the Rhone, really, as far as a growing region. Historically, politically, part of Burgundy. And cuisine-wise, part of Burgundy.
Yeah.
But until you get south of Lyon and then Valence, you don't really get into the Rhone Valley. But the climate is even pretty similar to Burgundy when you start in the Rhone. And in the Rhone, in that northern part of the Rhone, the red grape is Syrah. And the white grapes to know are Marsanne and Roussanne. And the Syrah from up there, from a few very famous places, Hermitage, Côte Rôtie, Saint-Joseph, Creuse Hermitage, those are well-known places and wines that age pretty well from Syrah as a grape. One of my favorite little sort of trivia things about Italian grapes and how they come to France, because obviously the vine traveled via the Romans into France, and they travel right up the Rhone River, which is the original part of there in the Côte Catalan near the sports, the Spanish border, modern day, are the first places you see the vine. And the vine traveled up the Rhone. And one of the grapes from Calabria, Majocco, is what adapted and became Syrah. It took about 1,000 years.
Wow.
But that's that grape that's done so well in the northern part there. And it's interesting to find it on the same hillsides. A very, very similar grape on the same hillsides all the way in, you know, southeastern Calabria.
Well, yes, exactly.
You know, sort of with you can see Greece on a clear day.
Agriculture is amazing.
Yeah, the history of
people and
agriculture,
exactly.
Is completely
right.
Fascinating.
Right.
And vines adapt. That's the, you know, mm-hmm. That's the other thing. But in those granite soils, they have a very different expression than they do, say, in Calabria, or than they do in Shiraz in Australia. And, you know, that's, but those are your basics up north there. The whites, there's also Viognier is a well-known grape a bit now in the States. Chateau Gruyère and Condrieu are the appellations. Those are both slightly painful to say, I guess, for an American.
Condrieu.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you watch your mouth. You watch your mouth.
Oh, my gosh. What is it with Viognier? I just...
What is it?
Yeah.
Honestly, for me, sushi
is so
it.
Unusual. Okay.
I love it with sushi.
Well, Viognier is really
which is not
a
French.
Very distinct grape varietal. Well, what do we eat with Viognier in France that works? I guess fish? No. There's probably not a lot of fish
not,
there.
Not
it
so much
river fish.
Fish
or something.
Cheese for sure. Yeah. Part of the tradition of Condrieu, and I don't want to get into it too long, part of the tradition is to make it a little bit off dry also.
Mm-hmm.
These are pretty opulent wines that are lower in acidity and have a great big richness to them.
Mm-hmm.
Some organ meats, some fish, but like delicate organ meats is where they do well. When the Rhone Valley, just like the Loire being long, the Rhone Valley is pretty long north to south.
Mm-hmm.
Once you head towards the southern part of the Rhone Valley, then you get to Mediterranean grapes. You see the climate change. All of a sudden there's a palm tree or two.
Right, which is such a surprise all of a sudden.
And once you see that, and it's because it's a couple of hours drive between the northern part and the southern part. And in that drive, you all of a sudden get to Grenache, and you still see some Syrah and a grape Mourvèdre that the Spaniards call Monastrell that does well by the seashore. And literally, we always separate it, but Provence begins in that southern part of the Rhone Valley and heads all the way down to the seacoast. And Provence is famous for dry rosés. And in the springtime, for goodness sake, look for rosés from there. And those are mostly Grenache, but a lot of times you see some Mourvèdre and some Syrah in those. And there is a whole kit and caboodle of varietals. And this is almost all red wine country down there. There are a few whites, but it's all reds and a bit of rosé as you get to the seacoast in Provence. And between the Côte de Roussillon that we talked about, just sort of to follow the map, and the center of France and that part of Provence, you find the Languedoc, and that is also interesting. That's where the soils change, and it becomes really interesting for Syrah in a very different expression.
So in the Languedoc, what is the difference in the soil? You're sandy all the way around, or no?
No, it's not sandy. It's not sandy and slate like you see in the Côte de Roussillon.
Okay.
It's much more, there's some granite. It's much more hilly. You get much steeper exposures there. You get cooler nights that the Syrah likes. It's a little bit less soil and a little bit more exposure and temperature variation there, which, again, grapes adapt very differently. So that's kind of how you see that stuff.
I think also the struggle of the vine is just what's so fascinating. No matter where the vine is, there's some sort of struggle going on to produce the best flavor in those grapes. And you just...
Or there isn't. Okay. And so you just get the fruit juice and you get it in big quantities.
Okay.
But in the places where the vine has to adapt and fight to live and live a long time, it may live a harder life and it produces fewer berries, but they have more intense flavor of the place and of the seasons. And that to me is the thing, that because France is so diverse and the cuisine is so diverse, you know, terroir is it's everything on the table affects terroir. Olives don't grow in the Loire Valley. Olives grow down south. And so you want to have beautiful green olives, and you want to have a cold glass of dry Provençal rosé on a warm day.
Sure do. Yep.
In a shady spot.
Goes perfectly.
That's beautiful, but you don't think of that in the Loire. You think of the river fish and the slightly off-dry Vouvray and the rich garnishes and the rich vegetables that go with that and the cream sauce that I know you want, Chef.
Oh, you know it. Well, and that's the thing. You know, once you understand the wine that comes from the region and the food that comes from the region, then you really understand pairing so much better. Because as you said at the beginning of the show, the things that grow together are what go together.
Yeah. An awful lot.
Often. Not always,
I'm exempting my Kundria and sushi affection, which really works incredibly well. Well, I think that's all we have time for on this giant topic. We encourage you to get out there and try some French wines.
Absolutely.
Open things with friends. Maybe taste a few comparatives. Super interesting.
And we'd love to hear from you about that, your experiences.
Yeah, you can reach us at ForemanWolf@WYPR.org. You can download this program or any of our others via podcast from the WYPR site.
The interaction is what's so great. So if you do have questions for us or just want to give us comments, we're very happy to hear it. And also you can follow me on Twitter through Chef Cindy Wolf is my handle.
Well, thanks for listening. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR.